Everyone, sorry about the slight delay. We're all running around like chickens with our heads cut off at this point in the session. Today we only have one bill on the agenda. It is Senate Bill 280. And the discussion that we're going to have today has nothing to do with what's in the bill, and it has everything to do with a series of amendments that we have that our council will be describing. And just for a little background for those of you who aren't aware, Senator Walker and I have been working on this issue for quite a while here with some of the people in this room, and it has to do with the tort caps that we have in Oregon, which have are now $100,000 for economic and $100,000 for non-economic damages if someone is injured by basically a public employee or a public agency. And this issue is very complicated, and there's court cases working their way through the system now. And we really don't know how some of these cases are going to turn out. But what we do know is that, and what we can get a widespread agreement on, is if there are to be tort caps of any kind in Oregon, they have not been updated for decades. And so if you're going to have them, they are unrealistically low. And so Senator Walker and I decided to proceed with a tactic of just trying to get those, if we can get consensus, to get those upper limits on the tort cap adjusted. So no matter what happens elsewhere in the legal system, if we do have tort caps, at least it will be something in this state that makes some sense. So, Senator Walker, is that a fair representation?
That is, Madam Chair, though please be advised that I am opposed to tort caps. I don't believe there should be a cap on an individual's right to sue, but we have them under the Oregon Tort Claims Act, and so I was pleased that you were willing to work with me on increasing those. And this comes certainly from the Jordan Michael Clark case for me, because I thought that case was absolutely egregious. And that's certainly the one that the Supreme Court is set to rule on at some point. But there are other cases, many other cases in Oregon, that have left victims without any recourse because you can't get a lawyer to help you sue for a mere $100,000 or $200,000. It just doesn't pay. And these people have been severely aggrieved. So I am happy we're here today talking about it.
Thank you very much. So we'll start by having our counsel summarize the matters that we have before us, and then we will go into the public hearing. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. State sovereign immunity is a remnant of the rule that the English king could not be sued in his own courts. The doctrine was adopted in the Oregon territories and was the law at the time of statehood. However, Article 4, Section 24 of the Oregon Constitution gives the legislature the power to waive sovereign immunity. It did this in 1967 when it enacted the Tort Claims Act, which at the time allowed negligent claims for up to $50,000. The current statute, ORS 30.265, provides that the sole cause of action for any tort of officers, employees, or agents of a public body acting within the scope of their employment or duties and is eligible for representation and indemnification shall be an action against the public body only. ORS 30.270 then places the following limits on liability for actions against public bodies. $50,000 for property damage, $100,000 of special damages, which are also known as economic damages, $100,000 of general damages, which are non-economic damages, $50,000 per accident or occurrence, and no punitive damages. SB 280 would increase the liability limits for public bodies in the Tort Claims Act. The Dash 4 amendments would enact the following limits. One, $100,000 for property damages. Two, $400,000 for economic damages and $100,000 for non-economic damages. $2 million per accident or occurrence. And the limits would adjust for inflation every 2 years, with the first adjudgment occurring on July 1st, 2011. The Dash 5 amendments would enact the following limits. $100,000 for property damage, $675,000 for economic damages, and $200,000 for non-economic damages, $2.5 million per accident or occurrence, and the limits would adjust for inflation every 2 years, with the first adjustment occurring on July 1st, 2013. The Dash 6 amendments would enact the following limits. $100,000 for property damage, $475,000 for economic damages and $400,000 for non-economic damages, $2.5 million per accident or occurrence, and the limits would adjust for inflation every 2 years, with the first adjustment occurring on July 1st, 2013. Finally, the Dash 7 amendments are the same as the Dash 6 amendments, but would enact a $400,000 per accident or occurrence cap on non-economic damages.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to start with me finding the sign-in list with Terry Solly from the Risk Management section of the Department of Administrative Services. Is just going to go over how the tort law works and give us a little background. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick.
You can go ahead and start.
I'm chasing a little spider off the table.
Oh, dear.
But he's safe. Chair Burdick.
We are an animal-friendly judiciary committee, some of us.
Chair Burdick, members. That was painless removal, so that was okay.
Member Sue, now that little spider is only for $100,000.
You'll have to find what's left of him first.
Ms. Griggs should get a raise for that. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Terry Solly, and I am the risk manager for the state. The risk management program is part of the state services division that is within the Department of Administrative Services. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today and to provide a bit of history of the Oregon Tort Claims Act, as well as some potential fiscal impacts for the state. I understand that the amendments under consideration would revise the Oregon Tort Claim Act limits and would allow for biennial adjustments under the Portland Consumer Price Index. The concept behind the Oregon Tort Claims Act, as committee counsel has already stated, is truly that of sovereign immunity, or the traditional immunity of the government itself from any suit at all. Also, as noted, the Oregon Tort Claim Act is a partial waiver of that sovereign immunity. The degree of that waiver has changed only twice since the act was implemented in 1967. It was modified once in 1975, and the last time it was changed was 1987, 20 years ago. The limits in place today, again, have not been adjusted since 1987. The Oregon Tort Claims Act covers all public bodies in the state, obviously including the state itself, but also local governments such as cities and counties, schools, and special districts. The basic policy determination implicit in any governmental tort cap, and with which you, the policymakers, must wrestle, is the balance between using public funds for government programs and services and using public funds to compensate for damages. There are three sections of the Tort Claim Act that I would like to highlight today, and again, counsel has already referenced, I believe, at least two of them, actually all three of them, and I am now on page 2 of your handout. First of all, ORS 3265, this section allows for the substitution of the entity in actions or suits against a public body's officer, employee, or agent. ORS 30.270 itemizes the current caps, and again, as counsel has noted, we're currently at $50,000 for any claimant for property damages, $100,000 for non-economic damages, and $100,000 for economic or special damages. The cap currently, the maximum per current caps, is $500,000 for any single accident or occurrence. And finally, I draw your attention to ORS 30.285. This section requires the representation and indemnification of the officers, employees, or agents of a public body whose act or omission was within the scope of their employment or duties. Josh Wee within risk management and the state insurance fund with our partners at the Department of Justice would defend and indemnify the public body and or its officers, employees, or agents under 30.285 or 30.265. DAS Risk Management has identified a range of tort cap limits maintained by other states. In a low to high scenario, we found that Nevada has a $50,000 per claimant cap and Montana has a $750,000 per claimant cap. Florida has a $200,000 per occurrence cap and Indiana has a $5 million per occurrence cap. Four states were identified as scaling or increasing their tort limits over time, very similar to the concept of the biennial COLA adjustments being contemplated under the amendments under consideration. These states were Indiana, Mississippi, Minnesota, and Utah.
Can I interrupt here, Madam Chair?
Certainly, Senator Walker.
Thank you. Staley, I need to understand these tort caps. Are these for state lawsuits, so these are under the sovereign immunity statutes. These are not tort limits for non-state agencies.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, that is correct. The limits that we itemized are specific to public body.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm now moving to page 3 of your handout. DAS Risk Management has obtained preliminary actuarial projections for a range of fiscal impacts or increased projected obligations through the 2007-09 biennium. Note that these projected increases are in addition to the normal tort risk charges that approximated $42 million for the 05-07 biennium. The closest projections to amendments under consideration would yield 2007-2009 increased obligations ranging between $8.1 million to $33.4 million. The $8.1 million projection comes from a potential tort limit of $75,000 for property damage, $300,000 per claimant, and $750,000 maximum per occurrence. The projected $33.4 million was using a $300,000 property damage limit, $1 million per claimant, and $3 million for per occurrence. Now, risk charges have already been set for 07-09. Thus, the agency risk charges for the 09-11 biennium would have to reflect two biennia of funding needs as a result of a change to the tort cap limits. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, thank you. I would be glad to answer any questions you may have.
These estimates by your actuary, now you said that the $8.1 million and the $33.4 million, these are in addition to the $42 million that you had during the 507
budget. Chair Burdick, that's correct.
And are these just state exposure, or is this all public bodies in Oregon?
Chair Burdick, that is just for the state.
Okay. So I assume other special districts and school districts and local governments would do their own.
That's correct, Chair Burdick.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Questions?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm going to follow up on that. Because OHSU is considered a state agency, even though a little over 3% of their budget comes from the state. So of that increase that you've just talked about, how much of that is related to OHSU?
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, none of that applies to OHSU. They separated from the state insurance fund several years ago, and I believe it was in the mid-90s, but I don't have the date, the actual year.
So this doesn't include any increase from OHSU then?
Chair Burdick, that's correct. It does not include OHSU or any other public body. This is just for the state of Oregon, its agencies, boards, commissions.
Thank you.
And then I had another question. Yeah, back to the other states, the ranges. Does every state in the country have a Tort Claims Act related to public bodies?
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, we had difficulty in identifying exactly what the various caps were in different states. There are some where the statutes are just silent. And I could provide additional. I believe I would have a table that I might be able to resurrect and provide to the committee that identifies It summarizes the states that I did highlight for you today, but there's also a listing of the other states, either where the statutes were silent or we simply couldn't identify what the statutes or the limits were. So I'd be happy to provide that if you'd like.
And I would like that. And, Madam Chair, a follow-up question is, if we have Tort Claims Act, which we do, and someone then becomes responsibility of the state to take care of because they have become incapacitated, have you factored that into what the cost to the state is under the current Tort Claims Act when they're not able to recover? So they get injured and they've become incapacitated, they sue the state, they're limited to 100,000 economic, 100,000 non-economic, and then they become a ward of the state basically because they can't care for themselves. So we've been able to compute how much that has cost the state of Oregon.
Chair Burdick and Senator Walker, that information would not necessarily be available to us. What we can quantify within the state insurance fund and risk management are the exact costs or the settlement costs of the claims. Those costs outside of that we would not have access to.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, Senator Barr?
Yeah, just a follow-up on your fiscal impact. OHSU is not included. What about SAFE Corporation?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, SAFE as part of the state in this case would be included. So they would be factored in as an agency here. It was simply that OHSU had separated from the state insurance fund several years ago and thus were not contemplated.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Okay, Noel Klein, Jerry Warren, and Scott Winkles.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
While they're coming forward, maybe counsel could answer the question, if not, give us an answer to a question. Would this measure, if it was to pass at some point in time, would it constitute trigger the constitutional requirement of a supermajority on local governments, or they don't have to follow the law because of unfunded mandate.
Unfunded mandate.
Mm-hmm. I can look into that and get back to you then.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question, and we will pursue that. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Chair Burdick, committee members, my name is Noel Klein. I'm the executive director of the City County Insurance Services. With me is Jerry Warren, who's a senior litigator for our agency, and Scott Winkles from the League of Oregon Cities. You have testimony that we've provided. I would like, rather than read that, just to paraphrase sections of that to tell you about City County Insurance Services. We provide coverage for 230 of the 239 cities in the state and 25 of the 36 counties in Oregon. As has been suggested in the previous testimony, there is a sound premise for protecting government agencies and their officers, employees, and agents from tort claims that arise out of their actions or omissions committed in the course of their duty. In reviewing our own claims experience, and what I'm sharing with you is the impact of those cities and counties who are members of our group. Frankly, we find neither compelling arguments for changing current levels nor a strong reason to oppose a moderate increase in caps and a reasonable escalator that allows limits to increase in a predictable manner. As we look back through our claims experience, starting when we began in July of 1981, we've handled almost 23,000 liability claims and paid out about $77 million. About two-thirds of these claims have been settled for less than $500. Interestingly, about half have been closed without any payment at all. A further one-third of involved payments of between $500 to $10,000, and over the life of our program, only 100 of those 23,000 claims have resulted in payments between $100,000 and $500,000. In our 26 years of operation, we've only had five liability claims where the payout has exceeded $500,000, and these larger settlements involve employment and law enforcement-related suits brought under federal civil rights and were not impacted by the state tort claims limit. Now, based on our experience, there have been instances, and about a dozen as best I can account, where our payments up to the $50,000 state tort cap on property damages has been inadequate, and the public agency has contributed additional funds to settle the claim. Many of these claims in recent years involve sewer backups and utility system malfunctions. So increasing the limits in ORS 3271A to $100,000 would allow us to extend coverage to address this exposure. We would support that change. However, I'm only aware of two claims that have come up against the $100,000 general and special damages cap in Section B, and in our 26 years of operation, only one claim involving a SWAT team shooting has been capped at the $500,000 limit. Any losses that are incurred by any of our members, we currently self-insure in the trust up to the tort cap limits of $500,000, and we reinsure beyond this level to protect the trust against suits that are filed in federal court and against catastrophic judgments should state tort caps be pierced. We will incur additional reinsurance costs if the aggregate tort cap limits are raised, and if that is your intention, we would like to suggest that an increase to $1 million would address the effect of inflation since the last change in limits, would address any situation our public entities have experienced, and would certainly create less price pressure than a $2 million or $2.5 million increase proposed in the amendments. We can certainly also support indexing of further changes to the limits. Taxpayers will incur extra costs not only for higher reinsurance charges, but also increases associated with a higher level of claims activity as it becomes more attractive for attorneys to bring contingent fee suits against public agencies. So to conclude, we'd urge the committee to continue the sound public policy of economic balance that's contained in ORS 3270. And in light of the potential for Clark versus AHSU decision to allow actions to be brought against individual employees and officers of public agencies, we would just urge caution in expanding limits, particularly if these limits may be applied to each named individual rather than to the public body itself. Jerry Warren would be happy to elaborate on any of the issues that are associated with limits and the impact that he sees in respect to claims. If you would like Jerry to do that, certainly answer any questions.
Before we do that, Mr. Klein, when you refer to the $500,000 limit, you're referring to the per occurrence limit, right, involving multiple people.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you talk about exceeding only 100,000 to 500,000 on page 2 of your testimony, it says only 100 of the 23,000 claims have resulted in payments between 100,000 to 500,000. Is that what does that mean? I mean, that just means per occurrence.
Their per occurrence claims that would have happened, a lot of those, frankly, again, would have been in federal court or claims that were settled outside of the state caps.
Okay, so I guess that's my question, is that if it's settled federally, is there a cap there, or is it unlimited if you're in the federal courts?
There is no cap in the federal courts.
Okay.
For federal constitutional claims.
Federal Constitution Court. Okay. Any other questions before we move on?
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to follow up because that was a point I was going to make. I don't see the sense in having a cap if you've hardly ever exceeded it, and it appears the only time you did was under federal law, correct? In your 26 years of experience.
in our 26 years of experience, yes, we have not had in state court a circumstance where we've had a judgment or we have paid anything above the state average. Let me have Jerry.
Above the state what?
Above the $500,000.
Well, but is that because the cap was in place or because the claim was? I mean, how do you analyze that?
The claim in that case was $600,000, and the cap, we paid $500,000 under the cap.
Okay. Let's hear from Mr. Warren.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick, my name is Jerry Warren. I'm an in-house litigation attorney for City County Insurance and have been with City County since 1992. I don't have any prepared remarks, but I do have a flurry of emails since I learned about this on Friday afternoon, a flurry of emails among county council and some city attorneys who are concerned about the impact on litigation strategies, for one, and I'll explain that. And just initially, in looking at the amendments that have been proposed, I think Mr. Klein, on behalf of CIS, would agree that if, and the county council that I've spoken to, Paul Snyder, for example, at Association of Oregon Counties, and city council, we haven't exhausted that pool, so I can't claim to speak on their behalf, but that the support would be there for the Dash 4 amendments. There is some recognition that 20 years has gone by and there haven't been increases, and there probably should be. So I think you'd find probably broad support for changes reflected in the Dash 4 amendments. And that those amendments, those amounts, while a little high in terms of the Bureau of Labor Statistics as to inflation-adjusted amounts, and the main objection, I guess, would be the $2 million, having it $1 million instead of $2 million, adjusting the amounts from 1975 and 1987 would take it to $1 million. But AOC, Paul Snyder, is looking. They're looking at the proposal right now, so I don't propose to speak for them. But the general feeling of on a conference call on Friday with county councils was that they could support Dash 4 amendments up to $1 million. What I want to address is the impact on litigation strategy.
Wait, before you skip across that, there's no $1 million in the Dash 4. Are you referring
I'm
to...
Just, Chair Burdick, I'm just suggesting that that's what they would prefer the amendment be as opposed to $2 million. I understand that...
Per occurrence.
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted that on the record.
As before the committee, I understand it's up to $2 million. My position is simply that I've heard support for up to $1 million, but not to $2 million, only because of the inflation-adjusted amounts and the sound reasons that those originally were put into place years ago. We think that the reasons are still there. With regard to litigation strategy, if this committee was making policy based solely on the Clark case, I think we'd probably all agree with Senator Walker that the circumstances, and I don't mean to pick on anybody on that case, but the circumstances are such that you'd say, you know, somebody ought to be compensated. Unfortunately, what we see is the public bodies are major targets for litigation where they aren't really at fault, but they have a deep pocket. And so, for example, in a case last year in Clackamas County, county shows up and there's a traffic accident. An individual wandered into the path of somebody else and was injured and had brain damage. A very serious case, very serious in terms of damages. In that case, with cap limits of $200,000, the county is able to say, look, we don't have any liability. They were suing the county, claiming that they should have controlled the accident scene and prevented this individual from walking into another car. You know, well, obviously the responsibility is on the individual in those circumstances, and the jury agreed and found that. But in terms of litigation strategy, had the limits been $875,000 that they were exposed to as opposed to $200,000, the public body probably would have said, we can't take that risk, and we need to pay this individual where there's really no liability, as ultimately confirmed by the jury. We need to pay this person $200,000 or $300,000. And so if you put those limits up high, the numerous lawsuits that we see, which really have no merit, we now have to say, look, we're going to have to pay these off much the way commercial insurers do, which, of course, they can easily pass that along to their insurers, and public bodies can't so easily pass that along, particularly in light of budget cuts and counties particularly being hit. And so from just a litigation strategy standpoint, we encourage you to consider what the limits do in that regard, that they do have a very beneficial effect of keeping the rates down for everybody. Many times also the public body will be sued where there's a joint liability situation, although now under the Act, of course, we have several liability unless the liability of one party exceeds 30%. So, for example, a county maintains a road. There's an intersection collision. The county gets sued because a tree branch is hanging over. The individual who turns into the path of the oncoming car, who really we probably would all agree is about 100% liable, the county will be sued and the individual will be sued. If a jury determines that the county is greater than 30% responsible, so this driver turns in, let's say it's $1 million in damage, it's a serious case, that the individual may have a $25,000 policy under the mandatory policy limits, and that's all he can contribute. Under the other statute that allows the reallocation of that damages assessment, if the county was assessed to be greater than 25% responsible for that, say a jury came back and said 70-30, 70% on the driver who obviously turned in, 30% because the county didn't trim a tree branch, under that allocation provision, you could have all that amount allocated above and beyond the percentage of fair liability for the individual, for the county. And so you really potentially increase the exposure that public bodies have when you increase these limits beyond what we've been experiencing in the lawsuits that we've had, and the ability to place a reasonable cap on their exposure. Public bodies are targets, and we are sued for things that this committee would find amazing. And the larger our exposure is and the higher those caps are, the more we have to consider whether it isn't more prudent to pay some amount when, in fact, they shouldn't be compensated at all, and everybody on this committee would agree to that. There are some other changes that we would like to propose because of the cases that have come up and said agents have to be reimbursed and such independent contractors need to be their liability needs to be accepted on behalf of the public body. I'd like to submit those later to the committee for their consideration. We have submitted those to the governor's office, and I'm not sure where they are in the process. But there are some other changes if you're going to look at changing the beyond just the caps that we'd like you to look at some of the decisions that say that independent contractors have to be defended and indemnified, that they can't contractually do away with that, because that's a big exposure for public bodies, too.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. And I don't know which of you would be the person to ask, but have you done a potential cost run, like we got some to ask, to see what the increase to the cities and counties would be and their viability rates?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, no, we have not at this point.
Do you have plans to do that kind of analysis?
We will, as soon as we can get that from our reinsurer, we will present that to you.
Great. That would be great. If you could just get it to us for the record, that would be great. Senator Walker?
Yes, thank you. Gentlemen, juries decide comparative negligence, don't they? That was used in one of your examples about the county or some public body being found to be 30% at fault. That's their job as a jury, correct?
Sir Walker, yes. They determine comparative negligence. But under the joint and several liability statute, joint and several liability has been done away with except to the extent that the parties have greater than 25% liability. Then there's joint liability, not just several injured party responsibility.
So basically one party can be liable for the whole thing if they're apportioned liabilities over 30%.
Chair Burke, that's correct. Now, it does depend upon whether you can collect from the other joint liability tortfeasor, but yes, that's correct.
And then my second question, Madam Chair, is I've forgotten the numbers. I used to know them by heart, but Oregon has very, very modest jury awards. There's very few jury awards in Oregon that have capped over $1 million. Wouldn't you agree?
You know, Senator Walker, I haven't studied that, but I certainly has been my experience there haven't been. I'd say we've been, but the cases that come to me, I'm in litigation. Mm-hmm. They're the cases that have gone through the claims process, and the risk managers have determined there isn't the proper exposure there, and we shouldn't pay anything. Mm-hmm. And so when they come to me, there's a good chance it should be a defense verdict.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. All right, thank you very much. Okay. Joel Robertson, Roy Magnuson, and Lori Christensen.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Robertson, and I'm president of Oregon Health and Sciences University. I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon and to testify on behalf of raising the limit of our state Tort Claims Act, but also to affirm absolutely and unequivocally that a tort cap must exist. I think if I have submitted written testimony, but I think OHSU is a public body, and if I want to really summarize my testimony, it is we take great pride and we take as a core part of our mission the ability to provide hope to those who otherwise would not be able to have any hope. And having a tort limitation is absolutely of paramount importance in our ability to do so. A cap is absolutely essential for OHSU. The choice is very simple. We either spend more money on liability protection or we spend money on healing, teaching, research, and community service. OHSU handles the most difficult and complex cases. These are cutting edge. These are cases that often would not and are not done anywhere else. The tort cap allows OHSU to say yes when others say no. The tort cap allows physicians to make decisions solely about what's in the best interest of patients rather than deferring to risk managers. And I think I would like to recount my own personal experience. I was actually in private practice for a year before I joined the faculty. The tort cap played a fundamental role in my decision to join the faculty at OHSU. I wanted to treat those patients that I did not feel that I could treat in a private practice setting. I wanted to be involved in the core mission that's at OHSU. Because of that, I did join the faculty, and in fact, when I got the faculty appointment, was probably one of the days of greatest excitement in my life. As a young faculty member, as I was seeking among many interests what I would pursue, two of the areas that I elected to devote my time to were ocular trauma and retinopathy of prematurity. I had the great privilege of providing most of the care for all of the patients who came into those categories in the state of Oregon. And with regard to retinopathy of prematurity, this is a blinding illness that affects premature infants. At the time I started in practice, there was essentially no treatment that was available. As I looked at caring for these, there was no effective treatment. As I looked at treating for these infants, one could not buy enough liability coverage to cover the potential awards that could be made that were being calculated based upon a lifetime of blindness and the current statute of limitations. I would have been undertaking exposure that would not have only put me at risk, but would have put my estate, my heirs, my kids, etc. It is one that a risk that I might not have been willing to undertake. Because I entered into this area of study, I've had the ability to over two decades treat children and see the outcome and see the condition markedly change. We had no hope then. We have great hope now. Our success rate has improved by more than 50%. There are hundreds of children that are seen today that would not have been seen had we not been willing to treat these. Not only this, my colleague, Dr. Earl Palmer, led a study that was centered here in Oregon called the cryo-ROP study that developed a new treatment for this disease. I was able to be a co-director of the Fundus Photo Reading Center, where we determined the primary outcome variable in this study and followed these children and gained much information. We've gone on to develop new techniques. Not only were we the only place, we could begin to extend this treatment to other hospitals. I personally carried a laser in the back of my car and took it across the city and helped treat these infants at Emmanuel. And I was the one to treat these children because nobody else would do it because nobody else was covered under the State Tort Act. Again, I think we've had a marked impact upon how a disease is treated and a marked impact upon hundreds of lives of children. And seated to my right is Lori Christensen, who can relate, if we have time, a similar experience with regard to the treatment of children with retinoblastoma. This is a tumor, it's a cancer that not only blinds but can kill young children. She is the regional expert and, for all practical purposes, the only person in this region who currently devotes a major portion of her practice to treatment of this entity. She would also have been unable to do this were it not for the State Tort Claims Act. Seated to my left is Dr. Roy Magnuson, who's our chief medical officer and has information that can affirm to you that quality does not suffer. In quite the contrary, we are motivated to make sure that we have the quality programs and the transparency that is necessary to demonstrate that we are not only performing equally, but are actually performing at or above a level that would otherwise be expected despite the complexity of those cases. We, in response to a question that was asked earlier, we have obtained some data with regard to the cost of the loss of the tort cap. The Aon Corporation, a national insurance and risk management consultant, conducted a study on behalf of OHSU to determine the cost of liability insurance if the cap were lost. And this is actually on page 3 of my written testimony. According to that study, there would be an initial one-time cost increase to OHSU of $19.6 million and an additional estimated annual increase of about $14.5 million. These two figures are based on expected case scenarios. Under the best and worst case scenarios, additional annual costs to OHSU could range from $8.7 million to $43.1 million, respectively. In comparison, the annual state funding for OHSU is currently $36.7 million, one of the lowest state appropriations to an academic health center in the country. Without the cap, additional liability insurance costs could consume a large portion or even exceed the state's annual funding for OHSU. And, of course, that does not include the untold millions that would be needed by public entities across the state to provide the legal protection that the cap affords. In closing, I would just like to reiterate our support for the cap. And unfortunately, I think if the cap were either abolished or markedly raised, those that would be most affected are those who are already most disadvantaged and disenfranchised. They are going to be the ones that will be impacted to the greatest degree. So we would like to see the cap increased. We think it is time to do so, but we would like to keep the cost of that at a moderate increase so we can continue to provide the services to the citizens of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Robertson, are you saying that some of these experimental treatments that you do at OHSU are literally not available at other hospitals in the city?
Absolutely. And part of the reason is that those providers are unwilling to take the risk when there is no limitation to their exposure. In fact, it is not uncommon for us to receive patients referred to our institution solely for that reason.
Senator Walker?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I appreciate the benevolence of OHSU and the fact that you do take on these cases. And quite frankly, I would state that many hospitals around the state send their patients to you because you have a Tort Claims Act. But let me just, and I can't let this one go. Jordan Michael Clark had a congenital heart defect, a simple procedure. You know that, Dr. Robertson. It was, and his breathing tube was dislodged in intensive care for pediatric recovery. So the argument that you do these experimental surgeries and stuff can only go so far. And this is my file from all the people who wrote to me after this case came out telling me what happened to them at your hospital. And they were simple procedures. They've operated on the wrong side of his brain for epilepsy. That's a pretty simple procedure, but they operated on the wrong side. So this is where I'm having, I get so worked up about it because I'm just so frustrated. I understand those procedures that are very difficult and new age, but these are simple ones, and these people are left with a $200,000 claim.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, you raise a very, very important question. And the truth of the matter is, every time there is an event that is less than hoped for, it is heart-rending. It is an incredibly unfortunate situation when that occurs, and all the sympathy in the world, and in fact, all the financial compensation in the world can't undo what has been done. That is one of the reasons that we want to see the cap raised. We believe that people should be fairly compensated, and we believe that is our part of our public mission, as is every other part of our service. But we also know that we live in a state that has limited resources, and we want to, at the end of the day, try and do the most good for the most number of people. And this discussion, this is absolutely appropriate. I'm delighted that we're having a public debate about this. This is about the balance that we strike, and this is about allocation of resources. And how do we want to distribute our often sparse resources to try and do the most good for the many? And that is what we are after, and we believe that in aggregate, although not every case will have a perfect outcome, we believe in aggregate that a tort cap accomplishes that.
Thank you. Final question, Madam Chair. Dr. Robertson, you indicated you would support an increase in the tort caps. Let me tell you that in all of the trial court documents, it's been challenged. I can't say unchallenged, but it's estimated that Jordan Michael Clark's care is going to be $11 million over his lifetime. He gets his care now from the state of Washington, where he lives, so it won't be the Oregon taxpayers paying for his care. It's the state of Washington taxpayers. But even if we increase the tort cap limits to any of these scenarios today, it wouldn't even get us close to $11 million. So let me ask you, which of these amendments do you think is a reasonable increase to the cap?
Obviously, none of these amendments get to that issue. What Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, what I have heard, you know, suggested, and I do not hear being discussed today, is the creation of some type of special fund to deal with those exceptional cases. And perhaps that is a way to explore an adequate remedy in that situation. But as I understand it, that is not one of the matters that is on the table today.
Okay. Madam Chair, I would say this is the first time I've ever heard of a special fund. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, Dr. Magnuson, did you want to go next?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Roy Magnuson. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for OHSU Hospital and Clinics. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the impact of the tort protection on quality of care at OHSU and follow up to Senator Walker's question. Picking up on Dr. Robertson's comments, I want to assure you that having a tort cap has not dampened our commitment to safety or to the consistently excellent care. If anything, It's allowed us to invest resources and improve systems in ways that reduce risk and improve outcomes for all the patients we serve. Today in the healthcare industry, there is a great deal of focus and pressure on improving quality and safety. And this pressure goes well beyond the historic pressure from individual malpractice cases. It's become a center of strategy throughout the industry. Secretary of Health and Human Services Michael Levitt outlined an agenda for the health industry that included four main elements. The first was the investment in electronic health information so we have our outcomes data available to us. The second was transparency of that information and providing it to the public. The third was transparency in cost and charges, and the fourth was aligning the payment for care with the performance of these activities. So our goal at OHSU has been to lead this effort in Oregon by implementing these recommendations. And in doing so, we hope to ensure that our care is evidence-based, consistent, affordable, and safe. So with respect to quality measures, we're currently building our ability to measure and benchmark against the best organizations in the country. We do that with three examples of benchmarking activity: the University Health System Consortium Quality Database, the National Database from Nursing Quality Improvement, which is the ANA Magnet Hospital Survey, and NISQIP, which is a most recent and rapidly becoming the national standard for measuring outcomes in clinical care and surgery. With respect to building an infrastructure, we're doing our best to implement an electronic health record, and the main purpose of this is to reduce medication errors, measure our ability to deliver consistently high-quality care, and actually drive evidence-based medicine into our order sets and provide care that's consistent. A few months ago, we won an award for top 50 hospital in America by LeapFrog, which is an employer-based quality initiative that identifies the major safety initiatives that hospitals need to be implementing and measures that in a survey form. We've begun efforts to educate consumers about quality by participating in CMS and other public quality initiatives, as well as providing additional information on OHSU's outcomes on our own website. Our goal here is to educate the public about the pros and cons of current quality measures, guide the public to sites that provide outcomes information about health care, and provide additional outcomes information not yet available to the public sites about OHSU's outcomes. So this is where the healthcare industry is going. And these investments are important, but they require resources. What I would like to suggest to you today is that while fair compensation for injury is very, very important, excessive compensation diverts resources from the critical access issues outlined by Dr. Robertson and also from these quality initiatives that could improve care for everyone. So our focus should be on increasing access on high-risk cases and reducing injuries on all cases. And that's what we've been working on at OHSU. So I thank you for your time and attention, and happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions from the panel? You said that you've been recognized for safety improvement. Was that based on your safety experience or on measures that you were taking?
The LeapFrog criteria are based on best practices. It's a group of employers who are trying to encourage hospitals to take on best safety practices and invest in things that make care more consistent and safe. So, for example, they have a survey with respect to using electronic health record or using specialists in your ICUs, and there's a list of dozens of safety measures that they want to see hospitals being implemented across the country. So we've participated in that. We've completed that survey, and as they rolled that up, we were in the top 50 hospitals in the country.
Thank you. Senator Walker?
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Magnuson, can you tell me how many cases in the last decade you've had, OHSU has had under the Oregon Tort Claims Act, and how much you've paid out?
No, I can't.
I would like that information because that would tell me how safe your record really is if you have a number of cases of people suing you for...
Senator Burdick, Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, I don't have that exact fact, but I think I have one that is relevant. We did recently look, and this is not those cases that necessarily came to court, but notification of a potential claim. We receive one of those for roughly every 7,600 and some patient visits.
7,600, you
yes.
said?
one per 7,600.
Do you have any idea how that stacks up with other hospitals or?
I haven't compared that. I'm confident about how it does, but I haven't actually sought the data.
Be kind of interesting data to get. Other questions?
Yeah, Madam Chair, there is an additional problem because when I was researching this issue a year ago, well, it would have been in 2005, I called the Department of Justice and they told me they were unable to confirm how many actual cases exist because litigants are not required to notify the Department of Challenges to the Oregon Tort Claims Act at the trial court level. So that's part of their problem in being able to tell me how many cases we've had. And you can't answer that. I know you
can't. Chair Burke, Senator Walker, I'm sorry, I can't.
Yeah, that's a question for the Attorney General's office.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Dr. Christensen.
I'm Lori Christensen. I'm a physician, and I have been employed at OHSU for 17 years in the Department of Ophthalmology. And my particular specialty is pediatric ophthalmology, and my subspecialty is pediatric ocular oncology. So I'm brave enough to fight cancer. I'm a little nervous about public speaking. We often hear of patients that have had undesirable medical outcomes, and I guess I am here today to hope that my testimony can portray to the committee the harm that can occur to a community if there is no tort cap. I'd like to echo Dr. Robertson's comments about retinopathy of prematurity affecting many, many infants and children. I treat retinoblastoma, which is the most common form of pediatric eye cancer. 90% of the cases occur under age 3.5. The disease comes in two forms. One is a hereditary form, where the child develops multiple tumors in both eyes and is lifelong at risk to develop other non-eye cancers based on their genetic makeup. The other form of the disease results in one tumor in one eye, and if it is dealt with appropriately, there will be no long-term sequelae in terms of their risk of getting other cancer. We are the go-to place absolutely for Oregon and for most of the Pacific Northwest. I've seen 12 new cases in the past 18 months. And it's a relatively rare disease, but potentially blinding and potentially lethal. And nationally, there are no overtly agreed upon protocols for the management of this disease. So when I take care of children with this disease, I'm often authoring extremely unique plans to try to save their life, save their vision, and not put the kids who are genetically prone to other cancers at greater risk based on the treatment that I'm giving for their eyes. I have a youngster with us today here at the Senate hearings who is 2 years old and who has two tumors in one eye and six in the other eye, and they've all been successfully treated. And he was diagnosed in utero with molecular genetic testing. We knew he was at risk. We examined him at a few days of age, and we were treating him at 5 to 7 weeks of age. So I would like to echo Dr. Robertson's comments that no one else in the state will do this. There are people in the state who know my name because when they hear of this disease, they refer immediately. They've never met me. I don't think that I could continue in this practice without some tort cap protection. And the last thing I would like to say is I am a children's advocate. I am very concerned. Many of the children that we treat for retinopathy of prematurity and retinoblastoma are very poor. And if the professionals in this community back away from this, and I must also add, there is a whole team of physicians at OHSU, myself, a retinal laser specialist, pediatric ocular oncology, molecular genetics, social work, we have to integrate and time our therapies. If that team backs away because there is no tort protection, many of these poor children, they can't fly to Philadelphia. It's a very significant issue in terms of access to care. So I thank you very much.
Thank you. And I take it you agree that an increase in the tort cap is appropriate.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Dr. Christensen is my daughter's former ophthalmologist. She's too old now, but I'm glad she just came to you for ordinary ophthalmology. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Bruce Miller signed up.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm a staff counsel in the Office of the State Court Administrator. The Oregon Judicial Department is not taking a stand on the policy issue that's before you today in Senate Bill 280, but I did want to make a point out a couple of things that are in the amendments concerning readjustment of the cap limit should you decide to adopt the amendments into this bill. It's essentially the same provision in all of the sets of amendments, so for convenience, I'll just refer to the Dash 7 amendments, page 2, line 19. The first point I want to discuss is the Portland Consumer Price Index, the CPI, that will be used to adjust the limit. And I just wanted to point out that those numbers are updated twice a year, once in February and once in August. The February number is based on July through December. The August number is based on January through June. And you'll note in the amendments that the adjustment is to go into effect on July 1 every 2 years. And the only reason I bring that up is to point out that because of that, when we make the adjustment, should you adopt this, we will be looking backwards to the most recent February number and then the numbers for the 2 years behind that. Rather, we won't be able to wait until that August number is released. Just wanted to make sure everyone understood how the adjustment will work should it happen. And then the second point I wanted to make that I hope to that we might clarify a little bit is the state court administrator is required to publish a list of the adjusted limits. And I just wanted to let you know that the state court administrator doesn't publish a lot of things, and probably the place this would end up would be in the appellate court advance sheets. It's one document that we regularly publish that would be a logical place to put this because it would go out to the legal community. And I just raised that in case you wanted to give us more direction on how you would like this to happen. Another way to approach it would be to say rather than publish, to give public notice. But in any case, if and when we were to publish this sort of information, I'm sure that we would disseminate it in other methods as well so that people would have access to it. Thank you.
Thank you. The value of public hearings, it never crossed our mind, anything of what you just said. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Okay, we've heard from the state, the counties, the cities, and I'm just wondering if there's anybody here from special district or schools, which are the other. Come on up, Jim.
Sorry, your sign-up sheet left before we got here.
Oh, you can always get another one in Senate Judiciary. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. With me today is Frank Stratton, our insurance program manager. As you know, the Special Districts Association represents approximately 900 special districts throughout the state of Oregon, and I guess we're the little guys. Approximately 50% in some cases, in most cases, approximately 50% of our special districts have no employees and are just volunteer special districts. About 70% of our districts have five or fewer FTEs, and I would, if I had to guess, I'd say about 40% of our districts have budgets, annual budgets of $100,000 or less. I'll speak to the Dash 4 amendments. Thank you. To the Dash 4 amendments, we received, I think, from your committee administrator a chart that gave us a breakdown of the 4s, the 5s, the 6s. We could support the Dash 4 amendments. We're okay with the first point. The second point, increasing the per occurrence cap from $500,000 to $2 million. We would prefer to see that at $1 million. The property damage cap increase from $500,000 to $100,000 would be okay with us. The CPI increase, we would prefer to not see that CPI increase. We think the legislature meets every 2 years. You're free to increase the cap at any time.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Ms. Squires, I have to be hysterical over that one.
Okay, Senator Walker, let's let her finish.
Let's let
point
her finish.
Made.
I'm sorry.
Point made.
The point's been made.
This is my association position. Thank you, Senator Walker. and then the effective date, we have no problem with. One thing that we would like to see, and I think the cities brought up the issue of independent contractors. We met with the governor's office. I think the date of my memo to Mr. Reese in the governor's office is February 13th. I think that memo was prepared a few days after we met in the governor's office where we had a meeting, and we were discussing doubling all of the tort the cap increases. So I kind of was surprised to see some of the other amendments floating around out there after I thought we'd all sat around the table and had some sort of a tentative agreement to increase those, to double those. Perhaps I misunderstood. I wasn't in the meeting, so that was just what was reported back to me. So we did bring up this issue of agent that's prepared in that memo to Mr. Reese, and we have not heard back from the governor's office about whether or not they would be willing to support that change, and Mr. Stratton will speak to that.
Frank Stratton, Insurance Services Program Manager, Special Districts Association of Oregon. Currently, we've identified an issue that we think could be corrected in the Oregon Tort Claims Act. Right now, it's required that public entities indemnify and defend their employees, agents, volunteers, board members, etc. Right now, there was an appeals court case where an agent was, or a private contractor to an entity, entered into an agreement with that public entity. The private contractor agreed in that contract to indemnify and defend the public entity under that contract. But once the private contractor was sued, then it went to the appeals court and they looked at it. It looked like the decision was, because the statute said that the public entity had to indemnify and defend that agent, being the contractor, being an agent of the district, that contract language for the contractor under contract to indemnify and defend the public entity was thrown out. And we think that's a bad situation. You could have a situation where you have a school district or a special district, city, county, entered into a contract with a multi-million dollar corporation to build a new facility, and that entity is considered an agent of the district. And obviously, it's better public policy for the public entity to be able to sign a contract with those contractors saying that they're going to indemnify and defend the public entity if something goes wrong, rather than be vice versa and have the public entity have to be subject under law to actually covering them. So we think that an amendment should be added to the Tort Claims Act, which allows the public entity, if it enters into those types of contracts, for the contractor to waive its rights to being indemnified and defended by the public entity.
And you're saying right now that the statute prevents that from happening because of this court case?
Essentially, yes.
Okay. Do you know what the name of that case was?
It was Welker versus Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. The decision was first affirmed, then vacated by the Oregon Supreme Court and remanded on grounds the appeal was not timely. So it's not case law, but the argument and the justification of the appeals court is on record, and we think that as soon as another case comes before the appeals court, that same decision will be made, basically.
Okay. Senator Pozanski.
Are you saying that the court did this in dictum, or is this something that was an argument? Did they actually comment on it?
Yes, they commented on it.
And when was that again? Do you know when?
Ninety-eight. 152 or OR App 190, 1998.
Okay, and basically what you're saying is ever since 1998 we've had a situation where the public body has to indemnify the private contractor. That's how it's worked in practice?
Correct.
Well, it's always worked that way in practice under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. It's just that there's a vagueness on who is an agent. It's always been a pretty gray area of when you're acting as an agent and when you're not. Usually in a situation, it doesn't necessarily even make it to court because the argument is never made that XYZ contractor is acting as an agent. Usually, a lot of times we're able to argue successfully that they're not necessarily our agent. Mm. But in this situation, it was a case where the TSPC, Teachers Standards and Practices Commission, actually contracted with a private investigator to do some investigation work, and that private investigator agreed under contract that they were going to, that they were not an employee, officer, and agent of the district. They actually stated that within the contract. Agreed in the contract that they would indemnify and defend the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. But then once they got sued, I'm not sure if their insurance wasn't adequate or what, why it ended up going back against the public entity, but the appeals court found that by virtue of the statute saying that the public entity had to indemnify under the Tort Claims Act, that the contract was null and void, that provision of the contract.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Mr. Green.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. It's always a pleasure to be before the Senate Judiciary Committee. It brings back bad memories of law school and the bar exam talking about all the liability issues. But I do want to talk a little bit about the Tort Claims Act and the cap that's currently in statute. The Oregon School Boards Association believes that the cap ought to be adjusted. We do support a cap, however, because if you don't have a cap, and I think you've heard from OHSU and the other public bodies that have been here, and in particular the state as well, costs associated with that can drive up things. And in schools, we are always looking at costs. And if we have to divert money away from the classroom, that means there's not a service going to boys and girls in the classroom. We got the amendments and the memo, I think your council prepared, late Friday, and we've sent this out to our folks to take a look at the various cost issues in there, and I don't have any information back. I will share it with every member of the committee and get that to you as soon as we can to see where we're at. I would tend to lean towards the -4 amendments. The CPI thing that our folks told us was, look, one of the things that deals with when you talk about liability insurance is if there's a cap, you know what the known costs are. So you can assume some things as an actuary with regard to that, what type of cases you may face, what's been happened in the past. With CPI, there is some adjustment there. There is going to be a known entity versus a legislature coming back 2 years, a year later, raising it again to something that's unknown. But they're looking at all that information, and I'd hate to say that I'd support one over the other right now without having that information, other than the fact that we realize the caps haven't been raised since 1987. We believe they ought to be adjusted upward to address the issues and the cost of actual doing business in the state that's occurred since then. But as for a number right now, I can't say. I would like to get that to you as soon as possible. We gave it to our insurance folks on Friday. We actually run a liability insurance trust jointly with the Special Districts Association that provides a lot of liability insurance to school districts. So we're going to have actuarial data back that can show you what the cost may be with the various amendments as it relates to school district liability insurance. I just don't have that information today.
That would be really helpful when you get it, and I apologize. We're kind of in the last throes of hearing Senate bills, and this we didn't have as much time on this one as anyone would have liked.
So. Yeah, I can appreciate that, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Can I ask
Senator
Walker? Thank you. Mr. Green, you know all about my concern about wired glass in schools. Schools in Oregon are aware of the dangers of wired glass. Some schools have taken the steps to remove old wire glass or retrofit it. And, of course, all new schools have to have no wire glass where people can impact it. Your schools that have not done that, what if a student runs through the wire glass and is killed, bleeds to death? All kinds of things. Horrible things happen to these children when they go through wire glass. Are you telling me they come under this Tort Claims Act, even though you folks already knew it was a dangerous item to have in your school?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I believe they would fall under the Tort Claims Act if that occurred. And Madam Chair, Senator Walker, we are trying to tell each and every one of our school districts to get rid of that wired glass, primarily because of the issues that you had brought up in previous sessions with regard to that. And the building codes have been changed so that our new buildings or any renovations or anything like that, we do get rid of it. My understanding is, yes, that they would be covered under the tort claims. That's my understanding. I'd have to check on that.
Madam Chair, that just goes to illustrate my point. The school districts know that it's dangerous and it shouldn't be in place. A child could run through it, be severely injured and damaged, and they can only sue for up to a maximum of $200,000 split between an economic and non-economic. So why would a district clean up the wire glass when you can only sue for a certain amount?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Walker, you know, for the districts that have done it, they've done it because it's the right thing to do.
Right.
For those districts that haven't done it, that may be a financial issue that they don't have the funds with which to do that. It may be a variety of things. And again, I would say we do support raising those caps, because if things like that occur, there ought to be a right of redress. There ought to be a right to recover damages sufficient to actually compensate the injured individual. Now, I can't say whether it's $500,000, $1 million. I think some of those issues are left up to either settlements between litigants or up to a jury as those things come forward. But we are in support of raising those caps. I think they're too low. You just gave a perfect example of where they're probably too low in certain instances.
And also a perfect example of why they need to redouble their efforts to get rid of the wire glass.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, the Oregon School Boards Association has worked very hard with our school districts to let them know about that. The other one we're working on is the light bulb issue, Senator Walker, that came out of your committee, and we're supportive of that, trying to make sure that our buildings are as safe for our kids, our staff, and the general public who use them.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Senator Barr.
Thank you. Jim, I guess you spoke to the CPI, or both of you did, actually. But, you know, an issue I see with that is that it's using the consumer price index. And, Jim, I think you're probably better positioned because you know that, you know, 198 was the 7-mile school districts. Many of them around the state are, you know, the CPI indexing level in Lakeview is probably much different than it is in Portland. And the same would go for any special districts in Lakeview or Harney County or places like that. But if you are adjusting for an index, it has nothing to do with the entity where you live. Any comment on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I think you bring up a good point. And, you know, one of the other things we heard kicked around the building was tying this to CPI for health and for health costs. And it's, you wanted to see a number go through the roof, that would be a number that would go through the roof. You're right. There are differences regionally across the state as it relates to cost of doing business around the state, whether it's Lakeview. Portland obviously is our largest metropolitan area, so a lot of things are tied to Portland CPI. Whether that's right or wrong, I know our actuaries are taking a look at that, and the cost of doing business is much different than it is in Lakeview, or, Madam Chair, I'll bring up my Troy School District again, in Portland.
It wouldn't be a Judiciary Committee without hearing about Troy.
That's right. We're going to write a book on Troy.
But, Senator Beyer, I think you're right. And that's something that our folks are taking a look at. Is that the right issue to tie cost increases to across the state of Oregon? I don't have an answer for that right now, but I know it is of concern to our folks. When I mentioned it to them, they said, well, you know, Medford has a different cost index than the city of Portland, but because our large metro area and the U.S. Department of Labor ties it to Portland, it's something they're going to take a look at.
Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, OHSU is not in Lakeview. It is in Portland.
Senator Pruszanski, did you have
a
question? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on any of these amendments to Senate Bill 280? If not, we will close the hearing, and we are adjourned.